The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Rain, be glad of these freshwater tears. Each pearled droplet, some salty old sea bullet, airlifted out of the waves, then laundered and sieved, recast as a soft bead, and returned.
What I admire is dew. To have the strength of dew, to pass apparitional through a place without trace or title. Yes, yes, there is ice, but I notice the water doesn't like it so orderly. What water admires is the slapstick rush of things melting.
All water wants, all water ever wants, is to fall. So, we use the fall to lift us, make of water its own tool, as simple as a crowbar or a well-tied knot. Open up the paddles, let it dam and pucker, swell, and with it, lift us like a bride, a kite, a wanted answer, breath no longer held, or like a boat. We're on our way and rising.
Water, water has been everywhere. It was the theme of National Poetry Day this week and a central issue at last week's meeting of the panel on climate change. So we've been talking to scientists, children's writers and poets about its role in their work. Simon Armitage came down to London to read some of his water poems at a National Poetry Day event at the Festival Hall. So what does water mean to him?
Part of it is very much to do with the area that I grew up in, which seems to be a sort of water collection point for the whole of the north of England. It was an environment of reservoirs and canals, a great big sort of epic playground really when you were a kid. And I think more recently I've come to understand that part of the world, and I'm talking essentially about West Yorkshire and the whole watershed, you know, as a territory that's been formed and morphed by water. Water's given it its shape in lots of ways, not just the way that it sculpted the landscape, but the way that it drove the industry there when we had any, and you know, the way that it gets into our bones and gives us rheumatism and we moan about it all the time. I think there's often a temptation, a poetic one, to think of water as some kind of, you know, sacred substance, the great leveller, its neutrality, its purity, its transparency, the way that Larkin talks about it. And I suppose that there's something lovely and contrary about the way, poetically, you can celebrate something that's see-through.
In 2011, you began a great project, which is called Stanza Stones, and you actually have your water poems carved into stones on the Pennine Way.
Yeah, it's been an incredible project. It's taken about a year and a half, even longer maybe, to see it through to completion. So there are a suite or a succession of six poems which are all about water in some form or other. So there's a rain poem, a dew poem, a snow poem, a mist poem. There's even a puddle poem. I was thinking of the puddle as the runt of the water family. And they're carved into stones along the Pennine Ridge from Marsden, which was the village where I grew up to Ilkley. The Ilkley Festival commissioned them. And they're carved, some of them, into natural outcrops and old quarries, places that have been, you know, brutalised in the past. And some sit there on new and introduced stones. And the project really takes its lead from an area which encompasses Ilkley Moor called Rombold's Moor, where there are all these cup and ring markings. I think more prehistoric carvings up there than anywhere else in Western Europe. And I just like the idea that, you know, for thousands of years there's been this ongoing dialogue, people going up there, carving things into stone to have a conversation with nobody, really, you know, the sky and the gods. The poems are all about water, and, you know, we do get quite a bit of it up there. In fact, after I'd finished all these water poems, it chucked it down for about 20 months. I started thinking that I'd cursed the whole damn place. Should have written about sunshine instead, or money.
And rather appropriately, the pinnacle of the National Poetry Day celebrations was a reading from The Room for London, which we have been to many times on this podcast, which is a boat on top of the Queen Elizabeth's Hall in London's South Bank, relayed to the whole of the South Bank of your water poems, among others.
Yeah, and lots of sea poems. There's no limit on the number of sea poems you can find that are out there. Everybody seems to have a couple of dozen to their name. You know, maybe it's to do with our maritime history, or maybe some of the sea runs in our blood. But yeah, on that, I keep referring to it as that daft little boat on the roof of the Queen Elizabeth Hall. It's not daft at all. It's beautiful and intriguing, and it looks like it's been marooned there after the Great Flood.
And it was based on the Joseph Conrad boat in the Heart of Darkness, the Roi de Belge.
That's right, yeah. Because, you know, there's lots of jokes when you're in there about Apocalypse Now and Mr. Kurtz, and it's an incredible view of London and the river. It's peculiar to be in a boat above the river, watching, you know, the tide roll in and out, and this strange diagonal view of the Houses of Parliament with the Eye for London. Is it called the Eye for London?
The London Eye.
The London Eye next to it, looking like a big water wheel. It looks as if the Thames is turning it round. So I think it's been a great theme for National Poetry Day. Everybody seems to have something to say on the subject, and it seems to be, you know, a route into other themes as well. A lot of them environmental and to do with ecology and so on and so forth. And I think these poems of mine, these Stanza Stones poem, the overarching title is In Memory of Water. And I don't know what future that predicts, you know, when they dig us out of the dust, because these poems are carved to a depth that they think that they will last about 1,000 years. So, you know, if you think about the way that the language has changed over the last 1,000 years and the rate of change now, you're actually carving hieroglyphics, really.
And the book of the project is just about to come out. You have it in front of you. It's beautifully illustrated, and it has illustrations of the poems in situ. Will you read us some of them?
Yeah, I'd like to read this poem, Rain. This is carved at a place called Cow's Mouth Quarry, which is actually on the Pennine Way and looks down onto this most incredible, expansive view. There's the whole Bay of Greater Manchester in front of you on a clear day. And then you can see right to the Welsh Hills and Jodrell Bank, and you can see up to Winter Hill in Bolton. You can see a bit of the Lake District, and you can see, you know, you keep looking west. So this stone where the poem is carved is really the first place that those great depressions barreling in off the Atlantic smash against. Rain. Be glad of these freshwater tears. Each pearled droplet, some salty old sea bullet, airlifted out of the waves, then laundered and sieved, recast as a soft bead, and returned. And no matter how much it strafes or sheets, it is no mean feat to catch one raindrop clean in the mouth, to to take one drop on the tongue, tasting cloud pollen, grain of the heavens, raw sky. Let it teem up here where the front of the mind distills the brunt of the world. Mist. Who does it mourn? What does it mean, such nearness, gathering here on high ground while your back was turned, drawing its net curtains around? Featureless silver screen, mist is water in its ghost state, all inwardness, holding its milky breath, veiling the pulsing machines of great cities under your feet, walling you into these moments, into this anti-garden of gritstone and peat. Given time, the edge of your being will seep into its fibreless fur. You are lost, adrift in hung water and blurred air, but you are here. I meant that last line in the sense of, you know, those little town plans that you come up against, and sometimes there'll be a button to press and a light goes on. It says you are here, or more usually there's just a big hole in it where people have jabbed at it with their fingers. You are here, but also, you know, you are here. You exist against all the odds. So be grateful.
And now for the puddle.
The puddle, yeah. I think the puddle's near the end. This poem is carved into two stone slabs of what they call causey paving. Old stone slabs that have been lifted from mills in Lancashire and then put up on the moor to help walkers go sort of springing across there without being, you know, eaten in the peat and the mud. And there's something quite funereal actually about these stones. They're flat lying, some grave size stones. Puddle. Rain junk, sky litter. Some May mornings, Atlantic storm horses clatter this way, shedding their iron shoes in potholes and ruts, shoes that melt into steel-grey puddles, then settle and set into cloudless mirrors by noon. The shy deer of the daytime moon comes to sip from the rim, but the sun likes the look of itself, stares all afternoon, its hard eye lifting the sheen from the glass, turning the glaze to rust. Then we don't see things for dust.
Simon Armitage and Stanza Stones has just been published by Enitharmon Press. We'll have more poetry at the end of this podcast. But for now, we turn to the science and politics of water with one of the writers shortlisted for the Winton Prize for Science Writing. Callum Roberts' book is called Ocean of Life, How Our Seas Are Changing. He's a marine conservation biologist based at York University. And he explained to the Observer's Robin McKee why our seas are so very important.
I was really trying to look at how the oceans are changing under our influence. For a lot of people, the idea that the oceans could be transformed by people is just silly because they're so vast.
You will highlight three main areas of destruction going on. We've got the amount of fish and other sea life we're removing. We've got pollution and we've got habitat destruction. And on top of that, we've got climate change. That's a heck of a combination.
Most of us focus on just one of those effects, and scientists are certainly not exempt from that. So people who think about global pollution talk about that to other people who worry about pollution. Those who talk about climate change do so in different places at different times. The same goes for fishing. So we never really bring together all of these different dimensions of change into one place. And I wanted to try and do that in the book so that people would become aware that the oceans were changing dramatically, not just as a result of a few minor influences in a few places.
You talked about the Firth of Clyde, of course, which you know very well and which I knew well as a boy because I grew up in Glasgow. And it was once upon a time quite a lively fishing area, but now has been absolutely dredged flat. It's like a monotonous expanse of shifting gravel and sand, as you put it. And this has been repeated all over the world.
Yeah, and what we've seen progressively in the last 200 years is that people have become better and better at catching fish, and they've devised ever more clever and effective ways of removing them from the sea. But the trouble is that that has had a colossal impact over time, and each introduction of a new fishing technology, be it trawling, be it monofilament replacing the hemp of nets, or echo sounders and modern electronics, we have ratcheted down the abundance of life in the sea, and we've been literally leveling entire habitats using bottom trawls and dredges, and now we've moved gradually down to smaller and smaller mesh sizes to catch prawns instead of fish. So we're sieving the sea, and over large areas this has transformed the oceans from fish dominated to invertebrate dominated. So we're catching prawns and mollusks like scallops where we used to be catching huge cod and halibut.
As you point out, in the 1930s, the UK fishing fleet landed more than five times more fish than we do now, and yet they didn't have echolocators or scanners.
That's right. I mean, it's incredible to think that, in fact, if you go back to the 1890s, we were landing more fish then than we do today, and that was using a largely sail-ploughed fleet. That just gives you an indication of the degree to which the oceans have been transformed by us. In fact, if you look back at some of the earliest records we have, dating back to the middle of the 19th century, correcting for the amount of fishing power which was being expended, we're catching 25 times less today per unit of fishing power than we did then, which gives you an indication of just how much we have altered life in the sea.
On top of that, we're also dumping DDTs and flame retardants in the ocean, and we're ripping up mangroves and marshland for hotels and ports.
Yes, and the problem is that the response, for example, to sea level rise is that coastlines are going to have to be ever more effectively defended. And the problem is that one of the most effective defenses is nature itself. And so where you have thriving habitats like mangrove forests or seagrass beds, oyster beds, those are much more effective at protecting coastlines than the things that we put in place of them, like great concrete tetrapods or sandbagged areas, and they come at no cost to us, really. They are self-repairing, and they will work over the long term, and yet that conversion and destruction of habitats is reducing the capacity of coastlines to respond positively to sea level rise. So we're doing things exactly wrong, really, if we want to have a resilient ocean that is going to be protective, that's going to be productive and healthy and safe for us into the future.
That's the grim bit of the book. Give us the message now. What should we be doing? What does Ocean of Life suggest is the prescription for halting this destruction?
No rocket science in there. We can put it in one sentence, even, that we need to protect more. We need to fish less, using less destructive methods. We need to waste less, pollute less. And by doing that, then we will be able to rebuild life in the sea to a much higher abundance, a much higher variety, so that it will be resilient to the stresses of climate change. Because unfortunately, looking forward, things are going to get worse before they get better. We're incredibly bad at dealing with those major drivers of the changes that we see, the increase in the human population and the demand for energy driven by our consumption and all of the greenhouse gas emissions that result from that. Those pressures are things that are incredibly resistant to any sort of political solution. So it's going to take many decades, I think, before we're able to reduce the pressures that are affecting the world around us, which means that we have to work now to build resilience in natural ecosystems and in the oceans so that they can cope during the tougher times to come and will be still in reasonable shape when we actually get our act together to go towards a low-carbon economy.
I mean, a classic example of the problem is the acidification of the oceans, which is never really talked very much about at climate change. They talk about whether the world's temperature is going up or down, but inexorably that carbon dioxide is being dissolved in the oceans and is making the ocean more acid, and with, you know, terrible consequences for shellfish, if nothing else.
The biggest losers in terms of ocean acidification will be shellfish, which is bad news because the way that we've been transforming the oceans by fishing is from fish to shellfish. So the main source of food which we have around right now is likely to dwindle. If you look back 55 million years, there was a period of runaway global warming called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, a big spike in temperatures. The ocean acidity soared during that time. And what happened to the calcifying organisms, things that produced chalky skeletons like shellfish and corals, was that they really didn't enjoy it. There was a complete retraction of coral reefs. So, you know, book your holiday to a coral reef now if you want to see one in great shape. There was also a major reduction in some of the big groups of phytoplankton, the very base of productivity of ocean fisheries. So the future is very difficult to predict when it comes to what the outcome of ocean acidification will be, but it's not likely to be good.
You raise a very interesting point about going to see the coral reefs while you can. Is there a role here for ecotourism?
Well, there is, and I think that probably, you know, tourism does cause coral reefs to get a bit knocked about, but compared to the other sorts of stresses and pressures they're under, it is fairly low on the list. So I think you can, with a clear conscience, go and enjoy coral reefs because they're facing much worse pressures. And the encouragement of tourism is increasing the amount of protection for reefs. So that's got to be a good thing. And we're also seeing moves towards valuing nature for these kind of non-consumptive uses, as they're called. So watching sharks is worth far more to countries like Palau in the Pacific than killing them and selling them for their fins is.
Can I also ask you about fish? I go into my supermarket, what fish should I not be eating and what fish should I say, yeah, I can eat that with a clear conscience?
Well, there's a lot of fish that are caught using very destructive fishing methods. So I would completely drop shrimp and prawns from your choices because they're caught using destructive trawls and dredges, or where they're raised by aquaculture facilities, those have come at the cost of a lot of coastal habitat like mangroves. Scallops are also bad, usually, because they're caught using dredges that flatten seabed habitats. Hand-dive scallops are good. They're more expensive. There is a small amount of scallops which are grown on ropes. But in general terms, avoid things caught using destructive fishing methods. Go for things that are low in ocean food webs. So instead of going for big predators like swordfish or tuna, aim for things like herring and mackerel and anchovies, pilchards. Those are all really good choices, and they're incredibly healthy as well. If you go for the big predators like tuna, there's another thing to worry about as well as sustainability, and that is that the flesh of those predators is good at accumulating the toxins which are floating around in the ocean. So they're picking up things like PCBs and pesticides, heavy metals, and from the Pacific now, fallout from Fukushima.
Callum Roberts talking to Robin McKee. Ocean of Life is published by Alan Lane. While Roberts' vocation takes him out on the ocean blue, ecologist Tom Morehouse is more likely to be found pootling along the riverbanks. He's an expert on crayfish, hedgehogs, and above all, water voles. So who better to attempt to do for the humble vole what Kenneth Graham did for ratty, toad, and mole in The Wind in the Willows? His novel is called The River Singers, and he read a passage to Richard Lee.
His mother slid into the water. She floated buoyantly, paddling with her feet, tail streaming behind her, head and nose in clear air. Sylvan rushed to the water's edge to get a good view of her, barging Oris out of the way. To Sylvan, the far bank seemed an incredible distance, but she made rapid progress to the trampled earth shore. In no time, she was out and grooming the water from her fur. She gave one final check for predators and called to her offspring. Sylvan. Yes, mother. Now you can swim. Sylvan leapt into the great river. Cynethys met him with a shock of cold. She flowed around him and beneath him, buoying him, dragging at him, buffeting him, pulling him onward, pushing him downstream. He swam instinctively, eyes fixed on his goal, the small, dark hollow of the far shore. She was strong, so he angled himself to compensate, cutting across her. He paddled, shoving at her with his paws, half flowing, half fighting, until the shade came to meet him, until he was within sight of his mother, reached for the bank until he was pulling himself out of the water, panted and exhilarated. "That was great," he said. "It was brilliant. I want to do it again." "Yes, dear. But please get out of the way so I can see how the others are doing." As soon as it was suggested to me that I should be writing a book about animals, then they immediately sort of leapt out as the thing to write about, because, yes, they've got lots and lots of dangers facing them, including the American mink. And so that's the basis for a really good adventure story. It's an alien predator. It's as, you know, it's as if a sort of alien came down and started hunting human beings. It's a similar level of what's going on. How do we get away from this thing? What do we do? How will we ever live? The American mink is a nightmare for water voles. It arrived in sort of 1950s, or rather, it gained a foothold in the countryside in the 1950s. And the water voles, who have been here for 10,000 years or so and doing very well, thank you very much, just have no defences against it.
So your characters are kind of put into this immediate situation of danger, which kind of gives them something to react to.
Exactly, yeah. The mink comes along the riverbank and it attacks them in their burrow, and when they wake up after the attack, they realise that their mother's missing. And so then they have to make a decision. Are they going to try and stay and defend themselves, or are they going to try and find a new home, a new place where the mink can't find them?
I was wondering why you've got the voles as river singers. Do water voles literally sing, or is it just that they live under the influence of the river's music?
Water voles really don't sing. They do a lot of squeaking, but not much singing. The idea was, if they were to have a mythology of their own, if they were to be sort of believable characters, how would they relate to the world? I mean, and for a water vole, the river is the nearest thing they have to a god. It's what keeps them safe. It's what provides them with all their food. It's where they live. And the noise that a river makes is a constant background burble. There's constant noise. And so if they were going to relate to that, then they follow the river, they sing along with it. And so they think of themselves as river singers.
The river's almost a character in her own right, isn't she?
Yes, absolutely. She speaks at various stages in the book, which is quite a difficult thing to get right, simply because you don't want, if a river is going to talk, it has to be believable. It was important that she's not a protective deity in any way. She sets a challenge to sort of reflect the fact that the water voles' lives are very, very hard, they're very dangerous and they're very brief, but they can be very beautiful at the same time. And the river also reflects that. She's very protective, but she has a destructive side to her. And so it's trying to find the balance between her being protective and yet a danger in her own right. The water was a line in his vision, a glistening expanse, and then he was in the air, diving towards the surface. In that instant, somewhere almost lost behind him, he heard a tiny snapping noise, like the crack of a reed stem. And then he burst through the surface and plunged down through the depths, pulling at the great river with frantic strokes. In this place, Cynethys raged. She fell upon him with a snarl, hurling him aside, beating him down, twisting him and tossing him aside. Sylvan kicked out, flailing at her, battling for his life. She flung him away, and for an instant he broke the surface, gasped at air, before she plucked him down into the dark. He smashed against a rock and was dragged into an undertow, rolling along the riverbed. He kicked again, his feet gaining purchase on something, and was thrust back to the surface. He drew a shuddering lungful, before she crashed over his head, pulling him down into her depths.
Because, I mean, you're a bit of a waterman yourself. Were you kind of drawing on all the time you spent by the side of rivers collecting samples?
Exactly.
And
I think by the time you spent sort of 8 years crouched down amongst the reeds and sort of in various places and, you know, being stung and bitten and generally, you know, urinated on from time to time, you know, you get the feel for it.
Did you ever worry about stepping into Kenneth Graham's shoes?
No, not at all. The Wind in the Willows and, you know, Watership Down as well are books that were there when I was growing up. And they become part of your sort of back catalogue that are just there and they're part of your childhood. But all I wanted to do is to set out and write a book from my own experience that showed people something about what I knew about the world and was an exciting, fast-paced adventure story.
But were you consciously reacting against Graham's ratty?
I mean, ratty, he rows a boat, he wears a waistcoat, he has a house with, you know, plates and, you know, and these guys are water voles, not characters. And so he was very important for me that it wasn't only an adventure story, but that the ecology was right, or as right as you can make it and still be readable, so not a textbook. And so I very much wanted to write an ecologist's adventure story, if you like.
Because, I mean, Graham's characters, they've got motor cars, as you say,
exactly,
and plates,
yeah,
and all that stuff. Does that worry you in a book, or was it just not what you're interested in?
It's not a worry, and I wouldn't say this is a reaction against that. It's more just, this is the book I wanted to write, and this is how it made sense to me. And at the end of the book, what I hope happens is you've read a really interesting story, but you understand a lot more about how water voles, the real water voles, actually live and the sorts of things that can happen to them. What I hope I did was constructed a world that we know nothing about, which should be very familiar to us because we go for walks down rivers, but we've never looked at it that way before. And so it's a twist on the world that we live in. And because it's very dangerous and there are all these things that can attack them and plausibly attack them, then I, as an author, get to put them in really difficult situations and see what sort of characters they are and how they're going to react. And, you know, that's a great thing to be able to do.
I'm wondering why children's literature as a whole is so full of animals where they're almost invisible in fiction written for grown-ups.
Children are interesting people to write for, simply because if they don't like something, they simply won't read it. They just go straight on the floor. And so in that way, they're very good critics. But they're also willing to accept, just as a fact, things that adults won't and things that adults will question. So they're not as cynical, perhaps. So talking water voles, you know, they'll buy into that immediately. And then it's just a question of how well written it is and whether it does what they're hoping it will do.
They're happy to make that leap for themselves.
Exactly.
I'm wondering if it's also partly because, as you say, your voles are confronted with all sorts of terrible dangers. I mean, their mother is killed fairly on in the book. They're pursued by this alien creature. Do you think children would find reading about that kind of danger happening to a real child just too upsetting?
Yes. As I was saying about having constructed this sort of alien world, you're free to do things to the characters that, if, as you say, they were happening to human beings in a different context, would be absolutely terrifying and horrific. But because they're happening to water voles, you can explore that without it being too frightening, yeah.
It's difficult to read The River Singers, this world which is kind of out of tune, which has gone wrong, which has got new unnatural dangers in it. It's difficult to read that without thinking of a hidden danger which threatens us all, including human children. Did you intend the book as a kind of parable of climate change?
That was definitely in the back of my mind. The one thing I was determined not to do was to have humans in there at all, because I think we're lectured enough about what we're doing to the environment and the world, and it doesn't make for easy reading. So I went more down the route of having a book which hopefully just carries people along and they enjoy the adventure, and at the end of it they think, oh, hang on, something's out of kilter here, and then they're free to go and explore that later on.
But it was very much an intention that you should conjure up this kind of disconnect with the world working the way, in a way that it shouldn't.
Yes, exactly. So the American mink is in there as, you know, it's introduced into this country by us, and it's definitely something that's wrong, if you can put it that way, with the British countryside. They do a lot of damage. It's not their fault, and they're an amazing creature in their own right, but we brought them here. And the upshot is that if we just leave them unchecked, the water voles will eventually become, if not extinct, then restricted to a few very, very small locations that are able to be defended. And so it's part of a wider issue, which is what you know, the way we're treating the world, and if we seem to be breaking things at quite a rate and then not sort of trying to put them right again.
You say that you originally started on the book because you had the idea, or you were given the idea, to write something about, you know, your specialism, and then the idea of the mink came to you as a kind of an obvious kind of peril.
Absolutely.
But
yeah.
Do you think that there's a kind of duty to deal with these wider issues in your work?
The book is full of facts about water voles, if you want to look at it that way, and it's full of the way that their world has gone wrong for them. But if you were just to come out and boldly state that, then that becomes a textbook, and nobody wants to read a textbook. They want to read a fast-paced adventure story. And similarly, if you have characters that are constantly in danger, then they can't sit there and complain about it. They have to pick themselves up, get on with it, which is, after all, the British way of doing things. And then you empathise with them and you think, right, you know, these poor guys, they're doing their best and, you know, they're getting on with it, and still whatever they're doing isn't quite enough.
So have we got the voles due to return in part two?
Yes, the part two is written, and round two.
A danger stalks once again.
Yes.
Oh dear, poor voles.
I know.
Tom Morehouse talking to Richard Lee. The River Singers is published by Oxford University Press. And finally, we return to dry land with another of this week's big poetry events, the Forward Poetry Prizes. The prize for best collection of the year was won by an old friend of this podcast, Michael Simmons Roberts, for his collection, Dry Psalter. So let's end by listening in to the prize-giving ceremony at London's South Bank.
And finally, Natasha McElhone reads The Vows by Michael Simmons Roberts from Dry Psalter, published by Cape Poetry.
The vows. We pledge to wake each morning face to face, to shun the orders of the busy sun. We promise to disturb each other's peace. And we will, yes, gaze at the pining moon. We'll pick out brine-blown glass gems from the strand. We'll read our future scratched onto a stone. We both believe that silence turns to sand, and promise not to add to the unsaid. We meet here as the raging sea meets land. We want the risen life before we're dead. Our passion will be squandered more than spent. We hereby swear to spend our days in bed. We're naked till we wear each other's scent, and recognize it quicker than our own. You start and finish me. You are my extent.
And for the last time this evening, William Seacart and Jeanette Winterson.
In between our first judging session in June and tonight, Seamus Heaney died. The poet who reminded us that poetry should be strong enough to help. And the poem uses language like graphene, which is the strongest as well as the newest material in the universe. And language is old material and new material all at once. So much has been written, but so much is still to write. And if you believe that life has an inside as well as an outside, then where will you turn to find that inner life acknowledged and upheld? Most of us can't turn to God, at least not directly. And so art these days has got double duty to do, making a place for that old-fashioned word, the soul. And our winner tonight is like John Donne. He's lived other lives and he has returned to the place where his soul is waiting. And I have a text message which has just come in from Carol Ann Duffy, which I thought you might be interested in. She knows, of course, who it is, and I'll read it to you. She says of our winner that he is the clearest and the purest voice in the new grace notes currently sounding in British poetry. We're all delighted by this choice. And it is Michael Simmons Roberts for Dry Soldier.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.